Welcome to the Vietnamese podcast. Today I have a very special guest, Helen Nha Vân. I'll be addressing you as Nha. I like that name a lot. And I was introduced to Nha, and I am so intrigued because it's right up my lane with food and ethnography and the work that Nha does in the food space and the history of food in Vietnam is of deep interest to me. So thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, sure. Thank you for having me.
So what is your earliest recollection of food?
So I guess everybody grows up, most people grow up in Vietnam eating their mother's cooking or some kind of like female figure's cooking.
Yeah.
And so I have always have like a very deep interest in food. And I think, of course, it shapes a lot of a person's memory and identity. And so every time you eat a type of food, it's kind of like make a connection to your cultural identity and what you are and also what you are not. And so I think it's a very interesting thing to explore.
Yeah. And I think, let me clarify the question I had. Mm-hmm. I think the earliest memory of food, what I actually mean is serious food that you've had, because I understand in your journey, you became a food critic, but so what is that one dish in your, you know, as you're coming up? It doesn't have to be like an early, early memory, but something that really, like for me, it's always been tikan, right? What is that for you?
I guess I really like mee kwai. So my father's side is from Hue, so from the central Vietnam. And so I think mee kwaing encapsulates a lot of like Vietnamese components and like the kind of textures and flavors that we like in cooking. And so I think that dish captures it very well.
Yeah. And then from that dish to actually becoming a food critic, where is that lineage?
So, I mean, I guess I wouldn't call myself a food critic. I don't think of myself as qualified to criticize anybody's cooking. I study food more in like a political and cultural sense. But I guess like how... I guess like mee kwaing and all those like very childhood dish have always like inspired me and influenced me to study food a little deeper, to study how it correlates to the social political making of the dish itself and how it relates to the nation and our identity. And so, yeah.
Where did that begin? Right? Because I mean, you just don't like, you're not like, 18 years old and you have like national identity and mee kwaing and like where does that happen? Where does that growth begin? Where does the obsession start?
I guess during college I took a lot of food classes. And then the summer of my first year in college, I got a job as like a food writer at a food magazine in Vietnam. And so when I start to like talk to the chefs in Vietnam and start to getting to know a little bit more about the industry, I also find out that like these people take food and view food in a very like different ways and they feel it very deeply in their culinary labor. And so that's how.
Yeah. So you weren't doing food critic writing. You were just writing about the process?
Exactly. So I was writing more about like this kind of like how people think about their labor, how people think about the food that they make. So they are these taste makers and they are also the trend makers. And so I write about them and their stories and how what they think and what they imagine when they make these foods.
How many years did you write for?
Around like 2 years.
2 years, okay. Yeah. And the reason I ask that is I think 2 years is enough time to give you some empirical ideas, some anecdotal ideas about whatever you formed in those 2 years, right?
Yeah.
And you said it's very different.
Yeah.
You said their viewpoints were very different.
Mm-hmm.
Different from what?
So I guess the people that I mostly write about mm-hmm. are, first thing first, are not born in Vietnam. And so the people that I wrote about are diasporic Vietnamese.
Got it.
So they are, I think, mostly second generation Vietnamese who grew up in either the US or other Western countries. And then they decided to come back to Vietnam and to cook Vietnamese food and to make a business out of it. And I find it very interesting yeah. because they could cook any food that they want. They can cook French, they can cook American, and they can make a lot of money out of it. But why Vietnamese? Yeah. And so I find it very interesting.
Yeah, that does sound interesting. Mm. And when you ate their food, did you feel a sense of how far off they were from the mark of a native Vietnamese born in Vietnam? Or did you feel like they knew that their tastes was in the same vicinity, but they were just trying to do different things.
Mm.
Like, I'd imagine when they're cooking and you're eating it, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. You could be like, in your mind, you could be like, it's either they got it and they just want to do something different or they're just missing the mark entirely.
Mm. Well, that's a really interesting question. So I think that these people, and a lot of them tried, when I asked them about like, oh, why do you decide to make Vietnamese food and why do you decide to sell Vietnamese food? And they would say, oh, well, my food is in Vietnamese. Like my food is fusion or my food is modern Vietnamese. And so it is that term modern mm-hmm. that makes it very distinct from like traditional Vietnamese cooking. And I feel like as someone who grew up abroad, people also told me that they feel like they're not comfortable enough to cook traditional Vietnamese food. And so I feel like their food is always very playful, right? Because they have all these different cultural experiences mm-hmm. with them. And but also they also have this kind of fondness for Vietnamese ingredients and food ways in it. And so I don't think that there is a mark there to miss. So they're not missing any mark, but they're just doing things very playful and tasteful.
Are you just being nice? Really feel that way?
I really feel that way. And yeah. my friends and I come back to those restaurants that I did my research
mm-hmm.
A lot. And so it's a real thing. It's, yeah.
I don't think I'm comfortable with my own identity. Mm. And when I think about my own cooking, I always feel like it's a copy of a copy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then when I hear you talk about these chefs in Vietnam, I'm just thinking perhaps I'm one of them, that I can't really knock it out like traditional Vietnamese cooking.
Yeah.
But it's more like I'm doing my best to
replicate
yeah. the taste.
Yeah. And that is very interesting too, because if you think about, and you're talking about food, right? But it also links back to like how you feel about your Vietnamese-ness. And a lot of Vietnamese-American are also feeling that way when they try to like reconnect with their ethnic identity, or when they try to come back, they are always like in this gray area yeah. of whether I am American or I'm Vietnamese or I'm in between and I'm not Vietnamese enough.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of things like that. And, you know, I think it's a very interesting to explore through food, through how you think about food as well.
I'm so intrigued because we were introduced by my social media producer, Nam. And I'm getting to know his world a lot more because I spend a lot of time with him and getting to know people like you and him.
Mm.
All of you speak perfect English, right?
Mm.
But you've all have left Vietnam at a relatively older age where you're fully set. You fully understand the pop culture in Vietnam. You understand, you're old enough to kind of like really articulate these food ways or these fashion ways or music ways, right? And I was, as I'm talking to you, I'm like, sometimes I get really insecure talking about you and Tanam because it's like, and here's where I get insecure. Thank you. Here's where I get insecure is like that you guys see the Vietnamese-ness coming from Vietnam, fully able to articulate that. And then when you come here, there's another way of being that somebody like me has no idea what, because, you know, I don't know my north, south, west, east in terms of culture. I really don't, even though I've been doing this for 5 years, I still remain obsessed with where the true north is, right? And so when I'm talking to you, I'm like, I'm confused because on one hand, your English and Nam's English is so spot on. And you guys feel like American kids to me. But I know, like, deep down inside, you can articulate Mi Quang very well, right? I want to ask somebody like you about food and the way you feel about culture being in America now. And how do you feel about now when you go back to Vietnam? Does it change you? Or are you kind of like, you understand Vietnam, you go back and forth, and it doesn't really, you don't feel, there's not really much of a difference to you in the way you look at food or culture or music?
In Vietnam?
In Vietnam.
How I look at food and culture in Vietnam.
Vietnam, yeah.
I mean, I guess, So I moved here when I was like 15.
Okay.
So I guess, and I haven't been back a lot since then. So there's always this, I guess there's always this closeness to the culture that I can always feel, right? But also because I live here and because in the US, there's always this pressure to sort of like,
conform.
Yeah, conform and being like an in-group, to form an in-group. And so I guess I almost feel like you when I come back to Vietnam.
What I wanted to hear. No, I'm just kidding. And I say that I say that jokingly, but also I'm dead serious about it, is because I feel like an alien sometimes, but now that, like, okay, that you were born there, you left at 15. Okay, so this is just a natural human thing that we feel like we want to, but I feel like I want to conform to being Vietnamese and American. So it's this constant weird.
I feel that too. Like, sometimes when I go back to Vietnam and people, you know, would talk about music culture, like who's the next rapper. People watch like rapping shows a lot, and I can't keep up with any of them. And even like, you know, all these food trends, and even the way that they speak is very different from the way that I spoke, because the language in Vietnam, especially youth languages changes. In Vietnam, it changes a lot, and it changes like especially with like TikTok and all these micro trends. And so it's very, so yeah, I almost feel like you. It's sometimes it's very hard to assimilate into the culture again. Yeah.
And we get this out of the way in the beginning of our conversation because this lays down the foundation of why you get into the PhD work that you're doing. Really?
Yeah.
Because if we don't cover that stuff, it's kind of like, oh my God, where does this stuff even come from? Like, why does ethnography and anthropology and archaeology, why does it even matter to to people like us, you know? I mean, clearly it does. And I feel like I'm on my, you know, my 6 year, my PhD in doing this Vietnamese culture work, right? Mine is, you know, spray and pray. I just like shoot everywhere and hopefully I can get a picture eventually of like where the Vietnamese culture is. But for you, it's very focused. And I want to know why you picked what you picked. And then we can talk about, I think, first of all, let's talk about your PhD thesis, the idea of what, where it comes from and what it's about.
Yeah, so my work, so I am examining fine dining in Vietnam, or we called it modern Vietnamese cuisine. as spearheaded by diasporic Vietnamese chefs. Upon the return migration waves of the economic reforms of 1986, the Đổi Mới reform, as we call it. And so I want to explore through like ethnography research. So I do interviews and archival research of policies between the states and the diaspora in order to see like how these two parties work together to imagine a modern Vietnam or a new Vietnam and to craft a new national identity.
Do you think that it's a new national identity being formed as a result of like diaspora people coming back and changing the food culture? Because that's a kind of like a big statement. I mean, are you saying that without us here in the diaspora, there would be like no real fine dining in Vietnam?
So here's the thing. So fine dining.
I don't mean to put words in your mouth.
No, yeah. It's fine. It's fine. So fine dining is, so first thing, fine dining is not like, it does not come from Vietnam itself. It's not, it does not come from within. And it comes, and this is because of like a historical formation of like fine dining as a concept. So fine dining comes from haute cuisine in France, right? And France has cultural hegemony in like the global stage.
Can you define culture? I mean, I know what it is. Cultural hegemony.
So cultural hegemony is it refers to when we as like a collective consciousness take a culture and place it at like the pinnacle of like elegance and fineness and refinement. And so the French culture is one of that. And it's shaped through these social political processes. And it's also, you could also say that it's like a manifestation of like inequalities and like colonialism as well.
Yeah. Okay. So then the French has cultural hegemony over Vietnam.
Over Vietnam, over world. Food. Yeah. And the world, because, you know, they established colonies all over the world back then. And French food was always like, when you mention French food, even right now, like,
there's a level to it.
Yeah, you don't think of French food as like, you know, unrefined or anything.
And what I understood, what I understand about French food and Vietnamese food, or French food in particular, is did they invent the entree, right? Because I don't think that we in Vietnam had an entree before, did we? Didn't we have like a piece of steak and then we have vegetables and like, you know, you see the modern like fine dining plate. And I think that we didn't have that in Vietnam. We were like everything's family style, or you eat like a bowl of soup, and it's not really like not really like stations of
it's not consisted of like many courses. Not like an a la carte where you have like courses and stuff. And so that culture of like having many courses also comes from like, you know, the royal cuisine in French as well, but also it's because of the establishment of the restaurants. And it also comes from France in like the 18th century or so.
So in your work, how do you get to the nitty gritty details of like all of the goings on of like the 80s or the, you know, how do you figure out like things that predate things that you could taste and feel today?
Yeah. So, if you think about like Vietnam in, so pre Đổi Mới, so pre 1986, right? We were completely closed off, and we were like doing things on our own. We had like a man economy, and we don't really welcome any Vietnamese American diaspora. And then there's Đổi Mới, and then only 10 years after the Đổi Mới that we actually normalized relation with the U.S. It was in 1996. And that's when the first few waves of like Vietnamese Americans, which is like the largest diaspora in Vietnam, start coming back to Vietnam. And so the food during that time, we had like, you know, all these industrial food and we have street food going on all the way. But there was no like fine dining or anything. And so fine dining only came during like maybe the mid 2010s. And the one of the biggest and most well-known restaurants at that time was actually founded by like a Western, like a European chefs and not Vietnamese, like ethnically Vietnamese. And well, and then around like 2016 or 2017, it was when like the first Vietnamese fine dining restaurant was like founded. Yeah.
And how did that change Vietnam's eating culture? Or did it? Did it not really?
Yeah. That's a really good question. So I think, for with like the introduction of these like upscale dining, right? It also correlates with like the increasing number of middle class people in Vietnam. And it's because of the economic reforms as well, right? Because we have all these like rising middle class who are very eager to delineate their class status through these new forms of consumption. So if you think of like luxury consumption, of like, you know, buying luxury clothing, so eating fine dining is like one of those things. And so I guess I wouldn't say that like fine dining food is in Vietnam is something that people would go to for like an everyday meal.
Right.
But it's definitely like a very good way to delineate class into like as used as a class symbol.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what you're basically saying is Noi Mai in 86 to 96, those years sort of changed the landscape. And then by 96, when more Vietnamese American diaspora chefs were coming back, the whole movement to fine dining started. Right?
I still don't have any like specific statistic of when like the first chefs start coming back. But I would say that 96 is the start of like, you know, the waves of Vietnamese Americans coming back.
Yeah. Do you have a sense of the question of where does the food taste better? Vietnam or Vietnam's enclaves here in Little Saigon, Orange County, and Chicago, you know, Argyle, and all these places, these enclaves like South, like San Jose, Houston, all boast like a really vibrant food culture, you know?
Yeah.
And my answer to all of this is Ang Do Quang Da, right? And then, so wherever you eat, you get used to it, and then you start claiming that's the best. But what do you think if you were an outsider, like if you were a French writer,
and
you were analyzing all of the food, and you were thinking like the fine, and I'm not even just talking about fine dining, I'm just talking about street food and all of it. I'd like to hear, and I, of course, I'm not asking for a comparison, which is better, but I'm saying, how should we look at it? You know, because I don't think they're the same. They're not the same. Yeah.
Well, just think about like, would people eat?
This episode is brought to you by Red Boat Fish Sauce. Some things will never be replicated by AI. The fragrance of fish sauce hitting a hot pan. The sound of your grandmother's voice telling a story only she knows. The feeling of a family recipe passed down through generations that are imperfect, alive, and completely real. Red Boat Fish Sauce has been a proud sponsor of the Vietnamese podcast for years because, like us, they believe in authenticity you can taste. And together, we're bringing you the Viet Story Bank, a recording service built on that same belief. Your stories matter. Your family's memories, your lived experiences, your history. These deserve to be preserved exactly as they are, untouched, unfiltered. They're human, so don't wait for the right moment. Learn more about the Viet Story Bank through the link in our show notes and pick up a bottle of fish sauce at H Mart, 99 Ranch, or redboatfishsauce.com.
Ever ask a question of whether Chinese American food is better than Chinese food?
It's very different.
Yes, it's very different.
So different.
And should it be evaluated
on the same?
On the same. Yeah.
It's a great response. Yeah.
Yeah. Or like Mexican American food, Tex-Mex, and Mexican mm-hmm. food. It's not. They're not the same thing. And so every time people migrate, they have to adapt to the culture, and they have to have these like culturally pragmatic strategy to adapt their tastes and flavors accordingly to their surrounding environment. And so I don't think it's fair to like pit two culture against mm-hmm. each other and try to like establish a scale, because that would not be fair to either of them.
And we're probably creeping into like cultural hegemonic thinking, right? That question is actually doing that. So look, let's stop asking that question from now on, because it is not comparing apples to apples.
Yeah.
You know, like Hủ tiếu in Vietnam is certainly at a much crazier, detailed level than any hủ tiếu I've ever had in America. Mm-hmm. I'm not comparing. I'm just saying that it's just very different.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, the hủ tiếu in Vietnam, the flavor is just dense. It's just super dense and pungent.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the hủ tiếu here is, it just seems much more robust.
Mm.
The ways I can describe it, it just feels really robust, but lacks the kind of like the fine details of the hủ tiếu in, you know, in Saigon. And so, yeah, you're right. It's just very different. And it just depends on where you grow up, I guess.
Yeah. And also, who are we cooking for? In America, you don't just cook for like Vietnamese, right? You're also cooking for these Westerners who are not used to these, like, well, let's say complicated flavors.
Yeah.
And so you kind of have to like, you know, mellow it down a bit. And so all of these kind of like transformation or adaptation to the local taste, to the local palates are things are like culinary changes that we see in a lot of other ethnic food in the U.S. Like Tex-Mex is very different from Mexican food.
I don't know if this next question pertains to your research or any sort of ethnographic traditions that you go down, but I have a chef friend, his name's Chef Nguyen. Mm. We talk about this idea of the cataloging of Vietnamese recipes. If you think about where we were cooking 100 years ago in the north or in the central, a lot of that is probably gone, right? Mm. How do we save the tastes and the archival practice of these flavors? I mean, in your work, do you ever encounter people that are trying to kind of catalog or archive this stuff?
So I would say that my people, the people that I study, is actually doing the opposite. They are always trying to
push.
Yes, exactly. So I study people who are trying to like craft like a new and modern national identity, right? So they're always trying to like imagine how Vietnamese food would look like. And they're always trying to imagine how Vietnamese food would change upon like, you know, these cultural changes and economic changes. And so I'm not sure about like archiving things.
It's so weird because I think that you and I, if I was if I put myself in your shoes, mm-hmm. I would go the other way. Mm-hmm. But you're a human being that is going into the future. So we're going in two different directions, right? Why do you think that you look forward and not
and backwards?
Yeah, because I look backwards. I'm like actually sitting here going, oh my God, I can't believe somebody's looking forward. Mm-hmm. Because when I think about looking forward, I just feel like it becomes dissipates. Yeah, it's just the weirdest worry.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. And I'm like hearing you going, wait, aren't you worried? Like we're losing our flavors. We're losing the mint. We're losing the smell of mamruk mamtom, right? And then you're like, no. I'm looking in the, how this is going, where this is going. Yeah. So where do you think that development, your focus on the future comes from?
Future. Yeah. Yeah. So that's a really interesting question. So I think like when, I guess for a Vietnamese, because I grew up in Vietnam, when I grow up, there's always this sense of like hope, and there's always this sense of like looking forward to the future. When you look at like how the party, how the state plan, the economic plan, it's always like this five-year plan, always looking forward. And so there are actually like anthropology studies about like how these economic development plans impact how people look into the future and always like hope and imagine the future. And so I guess that is why. But it doesn't mean that like people in Vietnam never look back into the past, especially during precarious times. When people cannot imagine a future for themselves, especially when, you know, even when I'm talking about like economic development, it also comes with like a widening wealth gap. Right. And so when people faced with like precarity and they cannot imagine a future for themselves, they will go back to like older times. And so, yeah.
That's where I'm at. I'm living in precarious times.
It's true. I do that sometimes.
But I think the point that you're bringing up about the party and the government thinking 5 years ahead all the time is it affects the way of the youth. You know, you're thinking about the future and you're thinking about where food ways are going. But when I think about like every time I think of modernizing food, it just becomes like gastronomy tricks being boiled down, being blended, and then all you get is the essence of like some foam or, you know, and I feel so defeated that something like ban canh tom cua is not just like still like hearty flavors of crab, and it's not like all it is just maybe chopped down a little bit, and then you have a lot of onions and so on. It's still real to me. But when you go into the fine dining and, you know, you have a lot of gastronomical tricks and smoke and mirrors, I feel like that future is never going to be interesting for me, you know?
I mean, I can see what you mean, right?
Yeah.
And it's and you're definitely not the only person who thinks that way. And there are a lot of, there are a lot of like, there are some food writers that are not a fan, definitely not a fan of like, you know, going over the top with these molecular gastronomy techniques. But also, I think with the people that I study, with the modern Vietnamese chefs, they think of themselves as artists. And so cooking is an art. And I think it's also, fair for them to allow them some room to be playful with their culinary creation, right? Because that is the way that they want to go with the art. And there are also demands for it. And so I think it's, and also I think it's fair for both kind of cuisine to exist. We still have street food and we still have fine dining. And so one doesn't have to like be demolished to like give place for its successor. So fine dining is not like a successor of street food or anything. And yeah.
Okay, so I know this is going to be a little bit of a hard exercise, but can you paint for me into the future of what modern Vietnamese food will look like? If you were to just like, if you were a food writer or a describer of the future, could you in fact tell me like, okay, here's where we're going with this. Is there a way to do that?
Well, I think it's very hard, right? Because that's for most of the Vietnamese chefs, for most of the fine dining Vietnamese chefs that I study, they are crafting it every day and they're trying to like imagine and reimagine Vietnamese food every day. So no one knows how it's going to look like. But what we do know right now is that if you look at the menus of like these Vietnamese restaurants, you will see a very large and a very interesting diversification of ingredients and techniques being used, especially in terms of like ethnic cuisine. So Vietnam has a lot of like, we have 54 ethnic groups, right? And so there are, so we are the Kinh population, and we usually eat Kinh's food. But there are a lot of like highland food or highland ingredients that we don't know about. And it's being incorporated into these fine dinings to give exposure to both the urban population and to the global palate as well. And so I think that with these introductions and with more exposure, I do think that a lot of like the quote unquote exotic and unfamiliar ingredients from the highland or from other ethnic minorities will get introduced to the urban population.
That's a really good example. 2 years ago, I was at one of these restaurants in Hanoi, and it was a highland restaurant. And you walk in and you knew you were in a different place. You knew the decor was like elevated, but you felt the highland because, you know, and you can read the signs and the literal stories on the wall talking about like where the food comes from. And then when you sit down, the plating's different, the way it's served is different. And then obviously the smell and the taste of the food is way different, although you know that it's ingredients that was used from Vietnam's earth. You know, but it was highland food done, and you know, these were like some white people that took me out in Hanoi. You know, there's like one of their favorite Vietnamese restaurants.
That's good.
It was highland. It was island based. So I see what you mean.
So like even if you go around Hanoi or any other big cities, for example, you can't find a restaurant that's like specializes in, I don't know, Hmong cuisine or like Cham people cuisine or, you know, other 53 ethnic minorities.
You don't.
You just really don't.
But can you imagine all of that's being lost decade after decade? I think it's going away. There's nobody archive. I mean, maybe there is. I would love to, if there's anybody archiving this stuff, I'd like to know. Cause I think that these are like treasures that are being, they're being buried deep in the earth and we can't, we can't get to it.
I mean, I think for, if we're talking about like ethnically specific culinary techniques, it's hard. You're right. It's hard to know whether it's actually hard to know whether it's already lost or it's still there, because there are very little exposure to it as like, you know, we as the urban population, mostly because of like the geographical access to the region, and you barely see the people in, you know, urban areas as well. But I think that a lot of the modern Vietnamese chefs and entrepreneurs are trying their best to connect with these populations and to bring their culture from the highland, from deep inside, you know, the forest, to the urban center. And I think, you know, that's a really interesting thing to see. And it's a really hopeful future trajectory to look
at. You know, I'm not sure if you write about taste and process in the kitchen, but when you think about Vietnamese food, if I was to say, hey, can you describe Vietnamese food? Like, what makes a dish Vietnamese? Like, I get pho and banh mi and all of that, but as in general, how do we, can you describe Vietnamese food?
So that is also a very interesting question, because Vietnamese like culinary palate is so diverse, and there is no, we're not like, even like regionally and ethnically speaking, we're not like homogenized. We have like the food from the West, the minh tay, is like very sweet and very like very rich. Like, we have these coconut cream, and we have pandan, and we have all these like palm trees and palm sugar.
Sounds like you're describing the people of Minh Tay. Yeah, they're warm and sweet and buttery, you know?
Yeah, and then
very rich.
And then rich.
I don't mean money rich, but I mean like rich in culture. They're just sweet and warm people.
Sure.
I wouldn't describe Hanoi that way, right?
Cut this part.
I said that, not you.
Yeah, okay. And then we have like, and then you have like the South, who's that's like very close to the West, and is also known for like a kind of a mellower taste. It, usually people would say that, like pho in the South is so sweet compared to the North.
Yeah.
Something like that. And then you have Central is like very, very strong.
Spicy.
And spicy.
Sounds like the people too. And, no comment.
Yeah. And then, and it's all, and then there's the North that's like very, let's say, I think the North is a bit more tan. Like, I don't know.
Tan is more pleasant.
Yeah, it's more
pleasant. It's pleasant. It's more a keyed, it's dialed down.
Yeah.
Flavors are nuanced.
Yeah, exactly. And so all of those, it's because we're not like really homogenized, like regionally. I think that makes like describing like a Vietnamese palate very hard to do.
Yeah, that's a good answer. Where do you see your role in the future of food and academics? How does that come together? What do you imagine your future? Because you're very, you're still very young, and you're starting out in this like amazing trajectory of like analyzing food as it relates to economy, as it relates to policy. Like, what does somebody like you in the future of the world between the U.S. and Vietnam, what do you do? What is the role that you see yourself doing?
I think I actually never thought about this question. but I guess the thing is, in terms of like academia, there are not a lot of people writing about like fine dining and Vietnam and the future. There are a lot of people writing about like street food in Vietnam and writing about the history of Vietnamese food. But nobody, I think not a lot of attention is put on like, you know, how these Vietnamese are imagine their future through food, and how it relates to like the political economy and the state, and other, you know, actors that are shaping the cultural and economic future of the country. And so I think that I would just love to document that and give it like a space in the academic landscape.
This is why the conversation with you or your generation with NAM excites me, because I am living on ground zero of the youth culture of Vietnam. But you guys are in America speaking full-blown English as an American to me, with the sensibilities of people who grew up in Vietnam, who understand Vietnam from the inside out. And the work that you do, I promise you, you'll be back on this podcast for many, many, many years to come, because I'm interested in the future of where you're going and where your peers and your colleagues are going with the study of culture. So that's why I want to start the conversation with you, because there, you're right, there's not a lot of people studying what you study. And there's not a, like if you think about the pathway of like where you're going, you could be literally working for some department of some ministry in Vietnam in 10 years, and you're like figuring out the nutrition, sort of dictating nutrition guidelines for the country. That's how I think of, you know, the people that study these things. You know, you don't know where you're going to end up, but eventually it's going to be somewhere very interesting. So I think continue the work that you do. And lastly, what do you, what does it mean to be Vietnamese to you these days?
That's a, that's a big question. Let's see. Well, I think to be Vietnamese is to just remember that you are Vietnamese no matter where you go. I don't have like any like grandiose question, like answer for that. But yeah, I think especially with like, because we talk about like cultural hegemony, right? And so I think that a large of the youth population are like emigrating out of the country for, you know, career and studying purposes. And a lot of the times it's just very hard to, it's very hard to assimilate to the new culture, but also to remember that, you know, where you're from. And so I guess like, the most simple thing to do is to always remember where you're from. And yeah.
Do you ever want to go back to work professionally in Vietnam, or do you want to stay in America?
I think, I mean, I think in the near future, I would still want to like stay in America, because I think this is because of the way it's like institutionally set up. It's the only way that I can put my work out academically and to, you know, give these like research about Vietnamese people a space in like the academic landscape.
There's an infrastructure in America that provides coverage for the work that you do. It's the only way I can put it. And I see that. I understand that. But I also hope that Vietnam does give space for academic researchers like you to provide infrastructure and funding to help develop all of these very interesting things that really can push the agenda of, you know, strengthening Vietnam's culture, you know, around the world. Thank you so much for coming on today. And I do, like I said, I do hope that you come back on the podcast, like, you know, once you have more of a determination on sort of what you're seeing in the trends, I'm really interested in this stuff. Thank you so much, Nia, for coming on today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.